We're still short one for a quorum, so but we'll get started here. Both of these bills are going to be laid over for possible inclusion, so here we have it. Now we have a quorum. And I got two sets of minutes here, and Representative Acum, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from the second?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I move approval of both. Just the second.
We'll do them one at a time, yeah.
Okay, the second would be
Representative Acum moves the approval of the minutes from April 2nd, 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion is approved. And for the third then, Representative Acum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the minutes from the third.
Representative Acum moves approval of the minutes from April 3rd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. Welcome to the committee, Representative Chair Purcell. I'll move House File 1998 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I'm just going to give a very brief overview, and then I have Mr. Wozlaski from administration here to go more in depth or answer questions. So, but House File 1998 is proposing to modify some of the renewable energy initiatives, offer more latitude for renewable energy on state buildings and properties, and we've had this initiative in place for a number of years now, and I think going back to 2003, I can be corrected on that, but that's my recall, and we've been getting a little more aggressive with this, trying to get more renewable energy and save the state a little money, save a little carbon dioxide, all of that stuff. So with that, I'm not going to read through the bill unless you want me to, but I do have Mr. Wozlaski here to help answer questions.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, Wayne Wozlaski with the Department of Administration. And I'm happy to just quickly highlight the changes if the chair desires.
I think if we need to, otherwise. Questions from members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall there being a program, when I get my electric bill and stuff, that has in there that you can donate to a fund for people that, the poor that have trouble with their utility and electric. I noticed the bill is getting rid of a limit. And it is possible then maybe that a site or building may generate more electricity and during a period would be receiving a funds back for being a generator. I would like to see added into this language something that said if that ever occurred, that any excess would go into that fund for those that can't afford. I have no problem with offsetting our electrical costs with renewable. I have a problem with the state of Minnesota being a profit center, getting more in than to offset the costs. So therefore, I think it would be appropriate that in the effort to become renewable independent, that if we do reach at any site or any facility where there's money that would be coming back, that would go into funding those that can't afford their electric bill. And I would ask maybe your testifier if he could look into that language for possible inclusion later.
Well, Mr. Wozlaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate the question, and we are working on some potentially clarifying language. The intent here is to not generate more than what's required to meet the demand in our state-owned buildings. So the intent is not to be selling back electricity on the grid system. So we are looking at some clarifying language to help address that concern. Really, the language is, if you think of our correctional facilities, more campus settings, it's to really help deal with that situation where you could have multiple buildings on a campus and you have you set aside some land that you are using for a solar installation. It's to meet that demand that you have on in those state facilities versus generating excess capacity that would go back on the grid.
Do Mr. Wislowski, do we have an idea how much electricity we use as a state? When you add up all of our buildings, has anyone ever come up with that figure? Or I know it'd be a lot.
Mr. Chair, we don't have a centralized collection point for that. It's with each of the state facilities. I think we on the campus have a pretty good understanding of our facilities. It also depends on how each building is individual metered. If you're getting down to trying to get to building by building specific, just as an example, the solar installation that was installed on the Senate building roof, that equates to roughly about 12% of the electrical demand for that building on average. So that was just a rough, in that case, it was about 12% of the electrical requirements for the building.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I tend to be optimistic, and not knowing in the future if there will be breakthroughs and efficiencies. And, it'd be nice to think that we would have more sunshine and brighter days in our future. And so just having that clause in there shows that intent is offset, but the state does realize that there are those that can't afford, electric costs and stuff, and that we would, if we things are more optimistic and comes out, and I think with general DG, you don't aggregate, at least in the current statutes, so that it would be site and facility specific that have to go on. So it's just a thought. Thank you.
Sounds like a future bill for Representative Quam. Representative Long. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, and I'll certainly take that into consideration as we move ahead. Representative Quam, I will advise you that, and you may know this, that utilities, and this varies from utility to utility, are not required to pay the producer at what they charge the producer. I have a wind turbine, and I get 3 cents. They charge me 10, I get 3 cents. If I'm putting something into the line. So, in essence, those of us that are producing are helping everybody else anyway. So I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Representative
Long. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Purcell for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a great idea. It does seem to me like on its face it's limited to the energy needs of the building. That's specific in the statute. Says that the pre-design needs to be for the energy needs of the building, but if there's additional language that could provide even more comfort, that seems fine. I know a number of public buildings have been able to reduce their energy costs with doing solar contracts, and my question is, have you mapped out how purchasing renewable energy for buildings will help the state meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it would probably best to follow up with you on that information. Our Office of Enterprise Sustainability has been doing some work around that. I personally haven't been directly involved, so I don't have the information, but I think we can do some follow-up and provide some data on that. The one thing I would mention, too, is, and this relates to Representative Quam's comments, it's really coming forward with this language now is timely because of the great efficiency that's happened in panels now. You're able to get a lot more production out of the panel systems now, and it's making it much more cost effective across the state.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it seems like this also applies to new construction or major renovations. How many new constructions or major renovations do we tend to do a year?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that depends on bonding bills. It varies significantly. I would say there's not new construction. Mainly where bonding bills are focused on taking care of our existing building stock. There is between the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, there's always a handful of new buildings that are included and would be covered under the statutory requirement.
Mr. Chair, last thing I'll say is we know that building energy use is 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the state, and offsetting that with renewable energy, I think, makes a lot of sense. So thank you very much for your efforts on this, Representative Purcell.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so on the front of the bill, you're striking the words "located on the building site." And on the back, it is, you're adding "on state-owned buildings and land." And I draw the distinction in terms of, there's a couple things that I'm just trying to understand. We're removing the cap on the number of kilowatts, and we're also removing the on or adjacent to kind of language on the front. So I'm just wondering what the intention is in terms of locality to a building, or what is the intention by removing that language and adding it on the back?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the intention is to really reflect the many campus settings that we have. So if you take a correctional facility down in Faribault, we may do a project on one of the buildings down at the campuses, but a solar installation may make sense on being just on land that's on that campus versus being directly on the building site. So we were taking a very literal reading of the building site putting a constraint in when you're dealing with campus settings for many of our state-owned facilities.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a curiosity, this is the conspiracy theorist in me speaking, so bear with me here a little bit. But you know, we also own a lot of state land for parks and for other purposes, and by adding "and land," does that allow for the use of those lands that might not be adjacent to a campus or for their own purposes to have a solar array or, you know, 20 acres of solar garden, if you will, in a state park, just for definitional purposes?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the intent, again, is to meet the demand for state facilities and provide flexibility on where that solar installation is located. The intent is not to create an avenue for community solar gardens to happen on state-owned land. If that was the case, there'd be other statutory constraints that would come into play. But I think, again, there's some potentially clarifying language that we can work on with the chair to make sure that we're real clear on what we are intending to do and with this language and what we're not intending with the language.
Right. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Certainly my desire is in concert with what you just described. So to the extent that clarifying language is necessary, appreciable, yeah. But the intent was just to clarify what the intent was.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, and Representative Albright, and I think we're right on how we, you know, we're going to put a bunch of solar arrays out in state land out in the middle of the Chippewa Forest or whatever. Nobody wants to see that right now, but you will see in some of the rest areas as you're traveling around, you're going to see a couple solar panels that run the lights in that building, that kind of a thing. And could we do that? Sure, I think that's doable. So, thank you.
Representative Purcell, I noticed all the signs at some of the small towns where they have, you're going too fast, and they have solar panels on them to run those signs that tells you to slow down because you're coming into town.
Mm-hmm. But bugs the bejesus out of me. I like the signs, but, you know, they'll hit you with the lights right away.
Representative Albright.
No more further. Thank you.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank Representative or Chair Purcell for bringing this forward. I think it's a great idea. And I appreciate Mr. Waslowski, I apologize if I said it wrong, your point to Representative Quam's issue about language and clarifying language and that you would look into that, and I appreciate that. And I also appreciate Representative Quam's idea, and while maybe not appropriate for this bill, I would certainly, knowing that low income or people of need often have least access to renewable energy sources, and so this might not be the bill, but I would welcome an opportunity to work with you to draft a bill that would be able to direct renewable energy to those people in need. So just for an idea for the future.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions mirror those of Representative Albright. Taking off the 300-kilowatt thing really, to me, opens this up really widely, and not necessarily opposed to what's been talked about here, but we're really broadening this a lot, saying you can build something anywhere and you don't have a size limit. And the intent may be good, but I do think that it definitely needs to be cleaned up a little bit, because my question was as well, could you, I guess the question would be, is there any possibility that you could do, if you wanted to, community solar using this language?
Mr. Waslowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not specifically familiar with the community solar provisions, but typically that's not something that the state sets up. And so this, in this case, this statute is related to the Commissioner of Administration's authority, and so we would need a funding source and for that to happen. And the other constraint that we have, so Commissioner of Administration has authority for leasing out state property. So, you know, we've been approached by, hey, can we have state-owned property as a solar garden site? There's constraints on when we lease out state property as well. So there's other statutory, when I referenced, there's other statutory constraints that come into play. I'm not as specifically familiar with the community solar garden provisions, but it's not typically something that's a state-operated function. That's another entity. So if you're working with another entity, you would presumably have to have, you'd be leasing out state land, and that statute would, and those constraints would come into play. So again, that's not the intent of it, and hopefully we can add the right language to make sure that that's understood.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is my concern, is not that we're doing something that you're talking about, that, but that this could be done, and in a few years just kind of latently sit there, and all of a sudden somebody picks it up and says, you know, I think we can do this. So I'm not against necessarily the concept, but I do have some real reservations with the way this is written, and it's being held over, I think, Mr. Chair, for possible inclusion, so that would maybe indicate it's not going to get another stop, and if it would happen to end up in the omnibus bill and all of a sudden become law and it just lays there for a few years without being fixed before it's there, I think it's a concern that we should all share, because I don't think it would be used as community, but by the same token, when you take off that 300-kilowatt limit, and you're saying you can put it anywhere, that's eerily similar to what's been done with community solar. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Well, I didn't think you must not have much of a list. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either the author or the testifier, I see there's no fiscal note on it, but everything costs money. So I'm wondering,
Representative Green, there is a fiscal note. In fact, you got it right there in your hand.
But there's nothing on it. It looks like there's no money.
That means there's zero cost.
That's going to be my question. And so, you know, obviously it's going to cost money to do. So where's the money coming from? I mean, you can't, so they're not going to just pop up on these buildings or on the landscape without some cost. So where is it coming from?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, from a fiscal note perspective, it authorizes, this statute is really, as been referenced, increasing the capacity. It's existing law that allows us to do the solar installations as part of our, when we're doing the major renovations and new building construction. So it isn't changing that. It's just changing potentially the capacity that could be built and how it is sited on a particular campus. So from that standpoint, it's not a project-specific change that has a fiscal impact. It's just broadening the, again, the where you can site it in the capacity of the overall system.
And Representative Green, when it's the way this law is set up, is that when we're doing a project, that they need to consider that in the pre-design. So the cost of installing that would be part, if it's done in that building, would be part of the building or the project that they're doing specifically. It wouldn't, it's not something that's going to cost the state money to for the pre-design, because that would be rolled into the project, whichever it is, either the remodel or the new building.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question, but I think Representative Purcell had a comment first.
The chair stole it from me, so thank you.
Okay. All right, so thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason that I bring this up, and I'm sorry for coming in late, I was in a discussion that was getting a little heated, so I had to get out of there. But the reason I bring this up is because we've seen a lot of these in the past, and whether it be wind or solar, the entities that put them up will produce more than they can use. And then they're allowed to sell that back to the energy companies at a retail rate. So they'll get the retail rate instead of the wholesale rate that the electric companies generally pay. And what happens is then that the electric companies have to put that on the grid, and it costs them money to do that because they're paying way more than they would otherwise. And so the ratepayers end up paying for the solar and the wind. So the reason I asked about the fiscal note is that when these things go in, is there any estimates as to what it might raise the rates for the payers of the, either the, whether they be co-ops or privately owned companies?
And Representative Green, I think was early, you might have missed that they were talking about the state office, the Senate office building that only covered the panels they put on there only cover about 12% of the electric use of that building. And I think Representative Purcell said had something about, and I'll let him go about what it costs him.
It certainly, Representative Green, it varies from utility to utility. I use the example of my wind turbine in my backyard, and I get 3 cents on a kilowatt when the utility buys it from me. If I'm generating more than I use, they charge me 10. So there may be utilities that are giving par on a kilowatt, but I'm not aware of it. There may be those, and maybe you are aware of them, but I don't. I would be, remiss to say something that I don't know for sure. But if you have the knowledge of that somebody's getting par in Minnesota on this way, I'd like to get hooked up to him with my wind turbine.
Representative Green.
Well, I think the testifier looks like he wants to say something too, but I'll leave it at that. But you know, when I see that the increase on what you can install is going up, that worries me, because if it is the case on the office building that they're not going to be using it all, I mean that's a different story. But I do know that we had set these kilowatts limits. Because otherwise you're going to have a whole bunch of people producing way more than they can use at the expense of other ratepayers. And as always, it's the people with the low income that have problems paying their electric bills that are going to get hurt by this. And so I'm not really sure why we need to take off the limits. But I'll leave it at that. But by the way, to answer your question, the information that I'm getting is coming from my co-ops up in our area that say that they, you know, if someone's generating way more, by law, they do have to pay for that to come back on the grid. So it's not just getting a break because you're producing your own. You're producing more than you can use, selling it back at a retail rate, and so the other rate payers are making up for your savings, and that's what that is.
Just a quick follow-up. My co-op is not that way, so I don't know how. Mine's Beltrami, and I'm getting 3 cents. They're charging me 10. So I thought that, Representative Green, I thought that was state law. But, well, I'll look into it.
Representative Albright, or did you want to be last?
No, just clarification. In my notes, Mr. Chair, I note that this bill has traveled through GovOps to the Energy and Climate Finance Policy Division, as well as now in our possession in State Government Finance. But on the bill itself, it only says that it was referred from GovOps back to Ways and Means. And so I'm just, not that I believe that there's been any additional engrossment or changes to the bill, but I'm just wondering, curiously enough, you know, has there been?
I'm being told that the reason that you don't show all the ones is that it wasn't amended elsewhere. They also went to GovOps, and then it went to Ways and Means, and then it goes up and down Ways and Means, but it wasn't amended, so there's not a committee report.
So it's not necessary to show the committee stops, even though it hasn't been amended? Division stops?
I think that...
So I guess my question is, so it was heard in those division stops?
My understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Quam, you have another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with a discussion about the costs and that, I'm not sure that in the when they have proposals that they get down to the detail for a facility or building what the investment in renewable energy is. At some point, maybe in this you could add of where it's highlighted the investment, that's the portion of the appropriation for the investment in it, and that way you understand that in 10 years or 15 years or whatever that it pays back. Just a suggestion for the author.
I didn't see a question there. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I think we might need to get a room for tonight because just to finish this bill up is the way it's going. Anyway, Representative Elkins.
No, Mr. Chair, I just am following the conversation between Representative Purcell and Representative Green closely. It's of interest to me, and I would like to know if the electricity being sold back to the grid is being sold back at the wholesale or the retail rate. Because if it's being sold back at the wholesale rate, I don't know why we would want to limit it at all anyway. So that's a comment, an ongoing question. I mean, if we find out more about that, I would like to know.
Representative Elkins and Representative Purcell, I think there's been a lot of discussion about that over the last few years about the whole issue about excess electricity being generated by individuals, and I'm not sure where the laws are at. I don't serve on the Energy Committee, so I know they've had discussions there, and I know we've done some tweaks in the past few years, but I'm not sure what they all are. Representative
Mr. Chair, and Representative Elkin, we'll get that information to the chair, and he can distribute that.
Thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under state net metering laws, it is the applicable retail rate for purchase of renewable energy. That's correct. But this bill doesn't touch that. That's limited to the energy use of the building. So there's not going to be any excess electricity to sell back under the bill.
I see Mr. Wozniak shaking his head. Yes.
That's the intent.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell. I apologize. I came late to this discussion, but I was looking at the first few lines of this bill, lines 1.7 through 1.9, that any state agency must prepare or at least plan for 2% of the energy needs of the building from renewable sources. And in this committee, Representative, we've had some previous discussions about the buildings and building space with regard to issues that have come through state gov finance, and how oftentimes architects have a statement with other people's money. 2% of energy savings, I understand the direction, but maybe part of the mandate should be to design buildings that are efficient in the first place, And a good example would be across the street, all of the volume and wasted space, you probably increase the energy requirements of a building that size in terms of functionality by 50% more energy to heat that building than the space that's actually needed. So just wanted to make that point.
Anyway, I guess that's more of a statement, too. Well, members, with that, we're going to lay this over for possible conclusions. And Representative Hertas, I've had much frustration in my years in construction with architects that design buildings as monuments to themselves, and you're right, sometimes they're not that efficient, but we also don't want a bunch of pole barns out there that may be the most efficiently built building, but they may not be what we want for our government buildings either. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
And
Representative,
thank you, Chair Nelson. And I think where we both reside, we might share a school district that had a building that had to be built like a maple leaf, not efficient use of taxpayer money or cost. Every time you've got every little jog of the leaf, you and I went to schools that were functional. We all know in construction that stacking space is cheaper than spreading it out on first floor. We can get into a debate about architectural things, but
that same school district
here in forever. This building, you know, we have 8 and 10 foot ceilings, not 40 foot ceilings.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like today to introduce a University of Minnesota student who is shadowing today. Her name is Grace Taylor.
You can stand up so we can.
So I was explaining to her that we have majority lead, minority lead, and who gets to say what when. So anyway, Ms. Taylor is studying animal science and agricultural communications at the University of Minnesota, and I thank you for allowing her to shadow our committee today. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Carlson?
Got it. Thank you. Welcome once again, Mr. Chair, to your committee. Before us, we have House File 2768.
And I'll move House File 2768 for possible inclusion.
Great.
In the omnibus bill.
Okay. Chair Nelson moves House File 2768 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. There's an author's amendment. Would you like to?
And I'll move the DE1 amendment,
moving
Mr.
The
Chair.
Chair Nelson moves the DE1 amendment. With that, Chair Nelson, would you like to proceed?
We need
to adopt the amendment. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The amendment passes. Chair Nelson, would you like to proceed with a description of your bill, please?
And Mr. Chair, members, this is basically it's a tool we use when we're putting together our budget, and it's to try and, number one, to limit the amount of outside stuff that gets contracted out by the state. We have state employees that can do most of this work, and we need to keep an eye on that because sometimes it costs us more when we contract stuff out. Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it costs us more. And this is also a tool we use at times to help balance and make our numbers work in the budget, and that's what the bill is about. And we're exempting the certain individual projects that are out there, cybersecurity being one. We understand that's done by outside computer. Most of it's done by outside computer programmers, and that we don't have that expertise at the state. And there's tweaks in here for the University of Minnesota or the Minnesota State Colleges that have. I had been doing some outside computer work also, so that's what the amendment did.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Do you have any testifiers today?
I think there's somebody from admin here. Or MMB.
Good morning. If you could introduce yourself, please, for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Members of the committee, my name is John Pollard. I'm the Legislative Director at Minnesota Management and Budget. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on the bill before you. Agencies across the enterprise use professional and technical contracts for a variety of reasons when that approach best fits the situation. The most common example is when the work is temporary in nature. Another example is what Chair Nelson just mentioned, when state employees lack the expertise to do what is required. So there are concerns that attempts to limit the use of contracting when needed may have an impact on the work that is expected from state agencies. That said, we appreciate the exceptions listed in Section 1 that apply to areas such as cybersecurity, public safety, health care, and corrections. Again, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack, for your brief and concise testimony. Any other testifiers for this bill? Member questions. I have Representative Elkins first on the list, and Representative Quam, you'll be next. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to vote for this. Well, actually, it's probably going to be laid over, so I'm not actually going to have a chance to vote on it, but I'm not going to support it. And in my relatively short time here, I'm observing that, first of all, I think that this doing this on a routine basis encourages agencies to pad their budgets a yearly basis in anticipation of this sort of thing, which I think is counterproductive. I'm hearing all kinds of testimony from agencies about how they're, I don't think they're intending to tell us this, but in the course of the testimony they are, that they're delaying things like patches on software. I think that this is counterproductive. I've never supported, you know, broad brush budgeting like this in any private sector context, though it's common there as well and has the same kind of pernicious effects. I think that we should be willing to, you know, take a deep enough dive to figure out in which places we ought to be cutting rather than just saying, okay, everybody's going to cut by 5% or whatever percentage this is. But I just don't think that this is a good way to do business, especially in this area.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Chair Nelson, I'm sorry, Representative Elkins. Chair Nelson, did you have any follow-up? Okay. Representative Quam, you had questions for the bill author or his testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to better understand what the general percentages of some of the other, you know, the major areas like Minute, you know, OHE, you know, do you have percentages of external versus internal employee salary, benefit, etc., costing?
Chair Nelson or Mr. is it
Pollard?
Pollard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, that's an interesting question. I think that it would probably vary from year to year, depending upon the projects that agencies need to do. And I think it would probably vary from agency to agency. I'll take a look at that and see if we can get you a breakdown. We do a report every year on professional technical contracts, and it does tend to vary quite a bit from year to year.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, I think it's useful that, you know, if we saw sort of a graph or something, or, you know, bar chart, et cetera, to give us an idea of what's happening on here. And other than the software actual coding, I have noticed, being on the Legislative Audit Commission for a number of terms, that sometimes there is a lack of capability in the project management of some of the things that come up. And so we run into issues because we don't have the expertise in how to run the rollout of some program. Would that project management type skill set be included in the 5% reduction, or would that be excluded? I'm just trying to understand.
Chair Nelson or Mr. Pollard?
Well, Mr. Chair, number one, and Representative Quam, it's only a 1%. If you look at the bill, it's only a 1% reduction, so it's not 5%. And Mr. Chair, in my work in through my years in construction, and a long time I worked for a building management company that we did work in, I've seen at times where one incident where they had a building that was a tall building and it had problems with the stack effect, and front doors would slam and you couldn't control the because the just the shape of the building create a big chimney that made it difficult to open outside doors. And they hired a contractor to come in and do after we had told them this is what's causing it, it's the stack effect of the building. The engineers that they had that worked in the building told them that. They hired a contractor. The contractor came back and said exactly what their employees told them. They didn't believe that. Then they hired another contractor, and it was a large amount of money that they paid each of these contractors, and they came back and said the same exact thing. And so before they would go and fix it. So sometimes when you do contract stuff out, you're not listening to your employees that you have that are working for you that know the buildings and know the stuff that they're doing. I've seen other times when I was an apprentice, the juryman I worked for liked to talk about a project he was on, and they ran into a problem in this project, and they called the engineer, the building the contractor, the architect, and they called everyone there, and the structural engineer, and they were all staring at this hole in the ground where there was a problem, and he couldn't stand it any longer, and he just said, you know, if it was me, I'd do it this way. And the architect looked at him and said, are you an engineer? And my partner said, no, I'm not an engineer. Well, then shut up, we'll figure this out. They shut the job down for 2 weeks, laid everybody off, come back 2 weeks later, and but the plan's exactly what he said to do. So, I mean, sometimes we don't use our inside staff that we have, and that's what some of this is, making sure we use the inside staff we have.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. And that reminds me, at the U of M, the professor from my deformable body mechanics course mentioned to me that when the zoo was building the aquarium for the beluga, the workers said, we're not going to build this because it's not going to work. And they ended up consulting someone that was familiar with such things that, you know, SeaWorld and others have built. And they had designed it so that it would handle the water, but not with a large, fish, whale, however you want to determine, a large creature swimming by in that additional force. And in that case, you're right, the worker knew that it was wrong, but they went and found a knowledgeable, topic-specific consultant to relook at the design and do it correctly, not just a general, you know, run-of-the-mill person, but someone specifically inclined that way, confirmed, and then designed it, you know, with knowledge, and it was done correctly until we, you know, I'm not sure what it's being. That space is used for something else now, but maybe the bird show thing. But the point being that when we come up with a special situation, I want to know that if you know this is in there, and well, that'll push us over, or we can't afford it because, you know, this would prevent us from bringing in a specialist. So if there's some new energy efficiency or new renewable energy concept that could be designed into a building, that we would be able to actually go out and get someone that is knowledgeable on that specific, you know, tight area. And that's why I asked about the program project management and some of the other things outside of the software realm, you know, how would this affect that?
Chair Nelson,
and Mr. Chair, in the builders, there's exceptions in here, and there's the ability for the commissioner to authorize where those things are needed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, or Chair Nelson. So again, I appreciate the stories and the examples, but if you can keep our questions to the bill before us. Representative Quam, you said you had a series of questions. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I think it's taken care of, but I wanted to enhance and confirm what the author was saying about and bring up a specific instance which involved state-funded projects of where the actual skilled workforce knew better than the original designer.
Understood.
And what was done.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Albright, do you want to go last, or?
I can go now. It was curious in the conversation, Representative Elkins, that you mentioned, because I think the some previous statements that Commissioner France has made, they agree with you. Although I think the Mr. Pollard's testimony this morning is much more generous than what Commissioner France has stated publicly, in as much as a quote that I am referencing from 2017, he says, "If anyone thinks that we can reduce government spending, that's fine. They need to step forward and tell us exactly what programs, what services they don't think Minnesotans need anymore, because that is the crux of the matter," he said. "If they want to do that, that's certainly their prerogative. They need to specify what do they want us to cut and where." And to the point, members, we've seen these type of bills before. And oddly enough, though, they're typically a tool that you use in deficit years, not when you have a surplus. So I find it a little bit odd that we're talking about this when we definitely don't have a deficit sitting around state government. And Mr. Pollard, in the body of the DE amendment on line 1.6, you state a very specific number, $890,000, or at least $890,000. So could you tell me what analysis was used to achieve that figure?
Mr. Pollard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, I couldn't. We didn't write the bill, and so perhaps is a better question for the author.
Chair Nelson.
It's 1%. That's for the 890. It's 1%.
Representative Albright, follow up?
Yes. So to Chair Nelson, then, why 1%?
Chair Nelson.
We could have gone 5. We could have gone. It's basically just putting it out there that we want to make sure that we have state employees that can do this work, that we're not just willy-nilly contracting stuff out. And it's a fairly fairly painless way of putting that message out. We have state employees that we've hired, we're paying to do this work. We shouldn't be contracting out work that we have state employees that can do the work.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pollard, in times past, when these types of bills have been brought forward, there's typically some type of an elaboration or a narrative in terms of how MMB would administer any known reductions or desired reductions. So how would you administer that if there were, say, a finding of 1% reduction? How would you administer that? Would that, you know, encourage a pro rata across all agencies, or is it specifically to the agency? Does it go back in the general fund? What happens when those savings or those cost reductions are found? What happens?
Mr. Pollard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, that's a great question, and we have done all of the above depending upon the legislation's past, the parameters, and what might be most efficient in past years. For example, a couple years ago, Representative Drazkowski had a bill to allow state employees to opt out of CGIP based on their personal circumstances. For example, they might have health benefits through the VA. And so when we did the analysis, we did not know how many people would opt out. But the legislation at the time gave us a target to hit in terms of savings. So in that instance, we did do it pro rata across agencies, and each agency took a percentage cut based on how many employees they had, even though we didn't know which employees might opt out and how it might affect particular agencies. In other instances, there may be legislation passed that gives the administration a target number, and you might be able to do it in one project. So I think the answer to your question is it depends on the legislation, the circumstances, and how it might best be implemented.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably, you know, should be using more appropriate, because these are cuts rather than savings. These are cuts to agency department budgets. So I guess my final question to the author of the bill, Chair Nelson, is, given the impact that this would have on other committee chairs' budgets that they're going through now, are they aware that this would potentially be cutting the budgets for these various agencies that they have as accounts within their finance bills?
Chair Nelson.
I'm not sure, but Mr. Chair and members, 2 years ago when we talked, you talk about being in surplus, 2 years ago when we were in surplus, this committee, chaired by another member, demanded or had in their bill 30% for certain agencies and 10% credit for others. So, like I said, this is relatively painless at 1%. It's a way to try and save some money and try to keep our employees that we have working and use their talents and their expertise and not pay double when we're paying somebody else outside the agencies to do the work.
Representative Albright, your follow-up?
Just to that point, and then I'll conclude. Chair Nelson, you mentioned in terms of when an agency can do the work internally as opposed to contracting it out. We've had numerous conversations around the table about various other projects where, in hindsight, it might have been more beneficial to the state of Minnesota if we had contracted out those services as opposed to brought those in. We won't belabor the point, but I think, you know, when we think about reducing or cutting budgets just for the sake of bringing everything internal, I worry at our own peril sometimes that we don't consider the talent pool or the experience pool that outside contractors might provide to our agencies and to our budgets when, to some extent, and I used this phrase a couple weeks ago, sometimes by excluding them from the consideration, we become almost penny wise and pound foolish. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Hertas.
No, thanks.
Representative Hertas passes. I have Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say to you, Representative Albright, I agree with you. It's really important to not be penny wise and pound foolish. I, like you, probably we would find agreement in that you can only spend a dollar once, get the best ripple effect you can. I think we would both agree that's a really good thing to do. I just want to make sure that there is on the public record the statement that there is not consensus at this table about surplus. When we have infrastructure, whether we're talking about IT, roads and bridges, or our school systems, that are not being funded to the need set that they have, or when we do not take inflation into consideration for the bills that we have already promised to pay, there is debate at this table, I'm sure, good, intelligent, healthy debate that would say there's not a surplus. And so I would just like to be on the public record as not agreeing that there's a surplus.
Yeah, thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, to that point, if I might do a follow-up question to Mr. Pollard. Mr. Pollard, yes or no? Based upon the February forecast, is there a surplus?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, it's probably a better question for the State
Pollard,
Economist.
Mr. Pollard, yes or no question?
She's
much
as he sees that.
Brighter than I am, and the answer is there's a lot of complicating factors, as you know, in what you're determining. Under current law, which is what we base the forecast on, we are projecting a positive balance in the out. Yeah.
Which would infer by your very statement, you used more words than I would, but yes, there is a surplus. You used words that probably elaborated, but to your point, thank you for affirming what there is known about the forecast surplus.
Thank you, Mr. Pollard. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair Nelson.
If you read the whole budget forecast, if you read down at the bottom, there's a thing there. If you include inflation in the spending side, there's $1 billion worth of inflation, so that $1 billion surplus, so-called surplus, that might be there in 2 years when is basically even. So,
Mr. Chair,
we can go round and round.
Mr. Chair, I'm fully caffeinated now, and so I look forward to that the follow-on conversation. But to Mr. Pollard and Chair Nelson, are we then deficit spending? Are we planning for spending in a deficit if, in fact, to your point that we were talking about including inflation in the budgetary considerations of the forecast from February, by your own words, then we should assume that we are in deficit spending mode?
Okay, I'm going to take that as a statement as opposed to a question.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Next on the list, I have Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't get into the weeds on whether we have a surplus or not.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. It is very much appreciated.
But from a process standpoint, I see $890,000. So I know that we're not a business, but as a business person, I would assume if somebody identified $890,000 in savings to me that can be cut, that there are things that we are doing that don't need to be done. And I'm curious, is that also your assumption? And if it is your assumption, what are those things that you've identified that would come up with $890,000?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, as I said in my earlier thing, this is, as putting a budget together, this is a 1% cut is a way to keep our bills and our funding and our target and meeting our target in our budget. So it's more of a mechanism to do that.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then we are to assume that we're doing $890,000 worth of work that is not needing to be done.
Chair Nelson.
I would say for contracting out work and contracting out for technical services that we have staff in our employ that can do that work, yes, then we are doing work that is unnecessary.
Representative Vogel, follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we are doing work that's not necessary, I guess then it's to Mr. Pollard, why haven't we identified that already and still spending money for it?
Mr. Pollard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel, I can assure you that if an agency thought that they were doing something that they didn't need to do and could reduce their budget, it would be in a governor's budget proposal. So we have not identified the $890,000 yet.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm hearing from the bill author that we have identified $890,000, and I'm hearing from the agencies that actually are spending the money that we are not spending $890,000 unwisely. How can we have something like this going forward if we're stating an amount that everybody says has to be there to be spent to the chair?
Chair Nelson, and perhaps, you know, I can just maybe quickly add that, you know, through the budget process, this is pretty typical. Working for a large municipality, having done this, this is a standard operating procedures, but Chair Nelson, if you would like to
it's a 1%. It's basically telling them that we need to make sure we tighten our budgets and we take care of them, and we have good employees that work for the state, and if they can do the work, we shouldn't be sending this work out to outside consultants and outside contractors. We should be having our employees that we already have in our employee and we're already paying doing this work.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because that $890,000 equates to about 10 FTEs. So I'm wondering, where are the 10 FTEs that you have looked at that we don't? I mean, to just arbitrarily, and again, I'm going from a business process, and I realize that in government it might be okay to just come up with arbitrary things, but I thought that's why we're here as a finance committee, to understand this stuff. And The thing that I'm really having difficulty with is if either we are doing $890,000 of work that is useless and shouldn't be done, or we're deciding that $890,000 that is now being done by consultants is going to have to be done by internal staff, which comes up to about 10 FTEs. And Mr. Chair, that's the question to the author. Which is it? Because that's what I thought our charge was as a finance committee, was to question this stuff.
So, Representative Vogel, just a quick follow-up from my previous comments. I mean, the agencies are clearly in the best position to find these efficiencies. Chair Nelson, if you want to continue to expand upon your rationale.
Mr. Chair, I think you hit it right on the head there. The agencies know what they're doing, what their work is, and they should be able to know where to find the efficiencies that they have.
Mr. Pollard, any further comments on that line of questioning? Representative Vogel,
I guess we
final
have
comment?
Charges as a finance committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Last on the list, I have, look at this. We got Representative Elkins. He's kicked us off, and he's going to close us out with his comments here at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But, you know, I think actually Mr. Pollard, you know, very succinctly, you know, portrayed the circumstances in which any organization ought to rely on contractors for IT work. One is that You either have a bubble in your workload that you need to cover, and the second is that you lack some specialized expertise in-house. So I think everyone would agree that our agencies ought to be staffing up internally to be able to handle their base load, and they ought to be developing the knowledge bases of their own employees to close as many of the knowledge gaps as they can. But there are always going to be cases where, and it's usually in project context, where you need to bring additional people on to handle the workload and to acquire expertise. And if I was an agency who had just been sent out to look under the seat cushions, basically, for 1% of the revenue, the easiest way to do it is to say, okay, I'm just going to spread my project a little longer so that I have the same expense, but I spend it over multiple fiscal years, in which case the savings are completely illusory, and you're delaying the benefits that you get from implementing the project. So I think that... I think this general approach to budget, and I've seen it both in my private sector career and my public sector career, has pernicious effects that we ought to be avoiding.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quick, Chair Nelson, real quick, if I'm understanding this right, the 1% cut, if any of these departments need it, they can still go to the commissioner for special help to supersede this. Is that correct?
Chair Nelson.
There's escape hatches there for stuff that comes up and needs to be done.
So we'd never not do the work of the state because of this. We would be able to do it, but they'd have to go through a few hoops per se, right?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson, at this time, would you like to renew your...
And Mr. Chair,
We got a last-minute request. Representative Quam.
Thank you. To this last comment and discussion about they would be able to, where would these funds come from? Is there a reserve fund sitting around that they'd be able to tap? Because this would be saying we're budgeting 99%. And they spend the 99%. It's dedicated here and there. Where would the special funds come from?
So, Representative Palm, agencies are used to this. They are going to manage their budgets as they
Mr. Chair,
just a comment, we will get to them in just a second.
The author actually has more knowledge on the subject, and I would hope he would be able to give us the actual feedback since he's done the bill, been around for many more years.
Representative Palm. We heard your comments.
It was a question.
I'm going
to the author.
Can we show
not
some
a comment.
Proper discourse here, please? We
That's what I'm trying for. To get the actual
a
person
minute,
I asked the question. Well, if you won't let the author answer the question toward him,
if you will let me finish, agencies manage their budgets all the time. This is a standard operating procedure. That was my comment to the body here.
Then, Mr. Chair, the actual state is,
Chair,
no, you are misconstruing my question. My question is, this is outside the actual funded budget. So where do they come up with the money? And I hope the author, since he has something in there that says, if they need to, they can tap something. I'm trying to find out where this money is they're going to tap it, and I don't quite agree that our agencies pad and have this slush fund sitting around as part of habit. I would hate to infer that like the chair just did. So if the author of the bill can tell me where this money would come from, since it's not part of the budget that would be authorized.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, as the current chair said, and state budgets, we give the money, we budget a certain amount for each department, for each department head. They have the duty to manage their budgets to make sure that they have the money that lasts through the end of the budget year and through the end of the biennium. And so what we're doing is we're just saying, we want you to find 1% savings in your professional contracts, and then they manage their budgets thusly. And They're very good at that, and they do that all the time, and that's the normal course of business for any public entity that's given a dollar amount. And when they run out of money, if they run out of money, they end up having to find ways or either come back to the legislature and say, we have a deficiency. There are numerous cases that I've seen in my time in the legislature. We've had years where we've had excess amount of snow, and the Department of Transportation's had to come back and say, we need excess money because we overshot our budget for plowing snow and salting our roads to keep our citizens safe. All sorts of things. We have floods, and they come back, and we have to go and take care of those things. This happens all the time, and this is, like I said, this is part of the managers in the Department of MMV, the Department of Administration, all these departments. The managers that are in charge of there do this on a regular basis all the time.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Seeing no other members on the list, Chair Nelson, would you like to renew your motion to lay over?
We'll just lay this over for
possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, that action has the bill has been laid over. House file 2768 has been laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mm-hmm. Seeing no further business, we are adjourned.